day half over. They rode the empty freight elevator down to the basement, where they found Barton and Hogan setting up. They had two friends on stage with them, a guy who played guitar and a woman who sang. A regular lunchtime date for all of them, once a week. Reacher hung back in the shadows. The room was large, but low. No windows, because it was a basement. There was a bar all the way across the right-hand wall, and a rectangle of parquet dance floor, and some chairs and tables, and some standing room only. There were maybe 60 people already inside, with more filing in, past a guy in a suit on a stool. He was in the far left corner of the room. Not exactly a doorman, more like a bottom-of-the-stairs man. But his role was identical, counting heads and looking tough. He was a big individual, broad shoulders, wide neck, black suit, white shirt, black silk necktie. In the near left corner of the room was a double-wide corridor that led to the restrooms and a fire exit and the freight elevator. It was the way they had come in. There were wide hoops of colored spotlights fixed to the ceiling, all trained inward on the stage. Not much else in the way of illumination. A dim fire exit sign at the head of the corridor, and another behind the man on the stool. All good. Reacher drifted back to the stage. The gear was all set up. It was humming and buzzing gently. Barton's precision bass was leaning against his monster cabinet, ready for action. His backup instrument was on a stand next to it, ready for emergencies. Barton himself was at a table close by, eating lunch, a hamburger. He said the band got free food, whatever they wanted off the menu, to a max of $20. Reacher asked him, "What kind of stuff are you going to play?" "Covers, mostly," he said. "Maybe a couple of our own songs." "Are you loud?"
"If we want to be."
"Do people dance?"
"If we want them to."
"Make them dance the third number," Reacher said. "Make it loud. Every eye on you."
"That part usually comes at the end."
"We don't have time."
"We have a rock and roll medley. Everyone dances to that. I guess we could bring it in early."
"Works for me," Reacher said. "Thank you."
All good. Plan made.
The house lights went down and the stage lights came up, and the band kicked into its opening number, which was a mid-tempo rocker with a sad verse and an exuberant chorus. Reacher and Abby drifted away to the near right corner of the room, diagonally opposite the man on the stool. They drifted through the crowd at the bar, following the right-hand wall, aiming for the far right corner. They got there just as the band started its second number, which was faster and hotter than the first. They were warming up the crowd, getting them ready for the rock and roll medley coming next. They were pretty good at it. They were hitting the spot. Absurdly, Reacher wanted to stop and dance. Something about the pulse of the beat. He could see Abby felt the same way. She was walking ahead of him. He could see it in her hips. She wanted to dance. So, absurdly, they did. In the dark, beyond the rim of the crowd, close to the wall, bopping away, maintaining some element of linear progress in a two steps forward, one step back kind of a way, but basically just having fun. Some kind of release, Reacher figured, or relief, or diversion, or consolation, or normality. What two people who just met should be doing. All around them, other people were doing it too, more and more. So that when the third number started, the place went wild, with people crushing in on the parquet floor, hopping around, plus a wide halo of more on the carpet, bumping tables, spilling drinks, going crazy. Make them dance. Make it loud. Every eye on you. Barton had delivered big time. Reacher and Abby stopped dancing. They ghosted the rest of the way along the back wall, behind the mass of dancers, toward the far left corner, where they arrived directly behind the man on the stool. They waited in the gloom 6 feet away until a gaggle of latecomers started down the stairs. The man on the stool looked up at them. Reacher stepped behind him and clapped a hand down on his shoulder, like a friendly greeting or a pretend surprise just horsing around, like some guys do. Reacher figured that was all the latecomers saw. What they didn't see was his fingers curling under the guy's shirt collar, twisting it, tightening it. What they also didn't see was his other hand, low down behind, jamming the muzzle of a gun hard against the base of the guy's spine. Really hard. Hard enough to cause a puncture wound all by itself, even without pulling the trigger. Reacher leaned forward and spoke in the guy's ear. He said, "Let's go take a walk." He pulled with his left and pushed with his right and maneuvered the guy backward off the stool. He stood him upright and got him balanced. He twisted his collar harder. Abby stepped up and patted his pockets and took his phone and his gun. Another steel P7. The band fell straight into the second song in the medley, faster and louder. Reacher leaned forward again. He yelled, "Hear that backbeat? I could shoot you four to the bar and no one in here would notice a damn thing, so do exactly what I tell you." He pushed the guy along the left-hand wall, stiff, awkward, four-legged, like the shadow he had seen in the Chevik's hallway. Abby kept pace a yard away like a wingman. She roved back and forth. She ducked in and out. The band went straight into the third part of the medley, faster and louder still. Reacher hustled the guy harder, ran him all the way to the mouth of the corridor, to the freight elevator, up to the street, out to the dock, out to the daylight. He hauled him around to the rear of the Lincoln. He stood him up straight and made him watch. Abby pressed the button on the key fob. The trunk lid raised up. Two dead guys, same suits, same ties, limp, bloody, stinking. The guy looked away. Reacher said to him, "That's you a minute from now, unless you answer my questions." The guy said nothing. He couldn't speak. His collar was twisted too tight. Reacher asked, "Where does Maxim Trulenko work?" He slackened his grip half an inch. The guy panted a couple of breaths. He glanced left, glanced right, glanced up to the sky as if he was considering his options, as if he had options to consider. Then he looked down at the dead guys in the trunk. Then he stared. He said, "That's my cousin." "Which one?" Reacher asked. "The one I shot in the head or the one I shot in the throat?"
"We came here together, from Odessa. We arrived in New Jersey."
"You must be confusing me with someone who gives a shit. I asked you a question. Where does Maxim Trulenko work?" The guy said the word they had seen in the text message. Biologically inexact. Either a hive or a nest or a burrow. For something that hummed or buzzed or thrashed around. "Where is it?" Reacher said.
"I don't know," the guy said. "It's a secret operation."
"How big is it?"
"I don't know."
"Who else works there?"
"I don't know."
"Do Danilo and Gregory work there?"
"No."
"Where do they work?"
"In the office."
"Is that separate?"
"From what?"
"The word you used, the hive."
"Of course it is."
"Where is the office?" The guy named a street and a cross street. He said,
"Behind the taxi company, across from the pawn shop, next to the bail bonds."
"We were right there," Abby said. Reacher nodded. He slid his hand around under the guy's collar, from the back to the side. He dug down with his fingers until he felt the inside face of the guy's necktie centered in the meat of his palm. He felt it through the cotton of the collar. A silk necktie, at that point about an inch and a half wide. More tensile strength than steel. Silk shimmered because its fibers were triangular, like elongated prisms, which did nice things with light, but which also locked together so tight it was virtually impossible to pull them apart end to end. A steel cable would give way sooner. Reacher bunched his fist, took up what slack there was. At first his hand was square on. All his knuckles were lined up parallel with the crushed rim of the collar, like he was hanging one-handed from a rung on a ladder. Then he rotated his thumb toward him and his pinky knuckle away from him, as if he was trying to spin the ladder like an airplane propeller, or like a tweak on a rein, turning a horse. all of which drove his pinky knuckle into the side of the guy's neck, which in turn tightened the stronger-than-steel strap against the other side of his neck. Reacher held it like that for a spell, and then he turned his hand another small angle, and then another. The doorman was calm. The pressure was all side to side, not front to back. He wasn't choking for lack of air, not thrashing around in desperate panic. Instead, the arteries in his neck were closed off and no blood was reaching his brain. Relaxed, peaceful, like a narcotic, warm and comfortable, sleepy. Almost there. Almost done. Reacher held it a whole extra minute just to be sure, and then he tipped the guy in the trunk with his cousin, and he slammed the lid. Abby looked at him, as if to ask, "Are we going to kill them all?" But not disapproving, not accusatory, merely a request for information. He thought to himself, "I hope so." Out loud, he said, "I should try the Washington Post again." She passed him the dead guy's phone. There was a brand new text on the screen, as yet unread. It had Reacher's own picture in a fat green bubble. The surprise portrait from the moneylending bar. The pale guy raising his phone. Below the photo was a block of Cyrillic writing. Some long screed about something or other. "What the hell is their problem now?" he said. "Ventresca will tell us," she said. He dialed the Washington Post from memory, having done it not long before. Once again the phone rang. Once again the call was answered. Once again he said, "Ms. Buckley?" "Yes," a voice said. "Barbara Buckley, what do you want?" "I have two things for you," Reacher said. "Some good news and a story." Chapter 41. In the background on the line, Reacher heard all kinds of hustle and bustle. A big open space, maybe a low hard ceiling, the clatter of keyboards, a dozen conversations. He said, "I'm guessing you're at a desk in a newsroom." Barbara Buckley said, "No shit, Sherlock." "I'm guessing you've got tickers and cable news on screens all around you." "Hundreds of them." "Maybe right now one of them is showing regional coverage of a fire in a lumber yard in a city you know." No answer. Reacher said, "The good news is the lumber yard was the Albanian gang's HQ. It's burning to the ground. Most of them are dead inside. The rest have fled. Their history. The things they said to you don't apply anymore. From when you had that meeting a couple months ago, in the back room of the restaurant. Those threats are now gone forever, as of today. We believe it was important you should know as soon as possible. It's a part of our victims' rights protocol." "Is this the police department?" "Strictly speaking, no. But you are law enforcement, which has many levels." "Which level are you?" "Ma'am, with the greatest possible respect, you're a journalist. There are some things better not said out loud."
"You mean, you could tell me, but then you would have to kill me?"
"Ma'am, we don't really say that."
"Are you speaking from there?"
"I would prefer not to discuss specific locations, but I will say it's very warm here."
"Wait," she said. "How did you even find me? I didn't report the threats to anyone."
Reacher took a breath, ready to launch into the second part of his script, but she beat him to it, like the investigative reporter he guessed she was, with a rapid-fire chain of fast connections and assumptions and wild-ass guesses, all of which ended up pretty much where he would have wanted to anyway.
She said, "Wait, the only person who could have known anything about this was the guy who drove me to the airport afterward, who was the local help I hired, who was ex-military, a fairly senior rank, which I know for sure because obviously I checked him out. So it must have been him who reported it, presumably to a friend or an associate with a particular interest, possibly in the Pentagon, which is probably where you come from. Some secret three-letter agency no one has ever heard of."
Reacher said, "Ma'am, I would very much prefer not to confirm or deny.
Whatever, she said.
Then she took a breath, and her voice changed a little. She said,
I appreciate the call. Thank you.
Your protocol works well. Feel better? You said you had a story for me.
Is that it? The Albanians are gone?
No, Reacher said. Something different. Involving you.
I won't go public.
I dropped the story. Not what a fearless reporter is supposed to do. This is the other side of the coin, Reacher said. This is where the fearless reporter breaks the case wide open. Because of the research you did. You came here for a reason, which wasn't the Albanians. You gave the impression you were much more interested in the Ukrainians. It would help us to know the basis for that interest.
I don't understand.
What did you think the Ukrainians were doing?
I understood the question.
What I didn't understand was why you were asking it. You're a secret three-letter agency. Surely you know why you're there. Or is this what you do now? You outsource the actual investigative part of the investigation to newspapers?
Reacher took a breath and launched the third part of his script. He said, clearly you derived information from somewhere, as did we, of course. But your somewhere was not the same place as our somewhere. I can pretty much guarantee that. Therefore, if we make you the star of the show, we keep ourselves in the shadows. We throw suspicion in the wrong direction. We protect our sources. They live to fight another day, which might be important. But the rules of engagement require that we hear a credible accusation from a credible person before we can proceed. We can't just make it up. It's subject to review.
Are you recording this?
I would need your permission.
You would admit I broke the case.
I think we would be obliged to spin it that way. Best all around. No one would look at our guys.
Plus, we don't care anyway. I don't want to go on TV.
I'm a journalist, Buckley said. No one would call me credible.
These are just boxes to check. We would take a tarot card reader.
It started with a rumor I heard from a friend of a friend. The story was, whatever was claimed politically, the intelligence professionals had in fact traced the fake news on the internet all the way back to the Russian government in Moscow. And they had also gotten pretty good at blocking it. Except suddenly, they had a sudden setback. The rumor was, somehow the Russians had gotten inside. They were operating inside the United States. And the blocking didn't work anymore.
Okay, Reacher said. But I got to thinking. Obviously, there was nothing coming out of their embassy, because we would have known. We're all over that place electronically. And they didn't move the whole project here, because it's not just us they're messing with. They're hacking the world. So obviously, they outsourced the American part of the project to someone who was already here. Like a straightforward business deal. Like a franchise.
But who?
The Russian mob in the U.S. isn't good enough. And anyway, no way would the Russian government want to be in business with them.
I tried to figure it out.
I had some information. The geeks at the paper follow this stuff.
They have league tables, like the NFL. All those old Soviet states are pretty good at technology. Estonia, for instance, and Ukraine, they figured. But Moscow and Kiev can't talk. They're at permanent loggerheads.
But Moscow can talk to the Ukrainian mob in the U.S. Same people, same talent, but a different place.
And it would be perfect cover. It's a very unlikely link.
And the geeks said the Ukrainians were just about good enough to do it in a technology sense.
So I figured that was what had happened.
An annual contract between the Russian government and Ukrainian organized crime in America. Probably worth at least tens of millions of dollars. I have no proof, but I bet I'm right. Call it a journalist's guess.
Okay, Reacher said again.
But then a couple months ago, they suddenly got much better at doing it. They went way beyond just good enough. It happened more or less overnight. Suddenly, they were doing really smart stuff. The geeks said they must have brought in new talent. No other way of doing it. Maybe a consultant from Moscow. So I went there to check. Naively, I thought I might see a Russian walking around town looking lost. So you already aimed to break the story. But I didn't. Where would you have looked? I had no idea. That was going to be my next step. But I never got that far. Okay, Reacher said. Thank you. Is that enough? Credible person, credible reason. The boxes are checked. Thank you again for the first part of the call. I do feel better. It's a great feeling, Reacher said, isn't it? You're alive, and they ain't. At the end of their hour, Barton and Hogan came up to the street, damp with exertion, loaded with gear. Ventresca was helping them. He read the new text, the photograph, in the fat green bubble. He said, "This is absurd." Reacher said, "He took me by surprise." "Not the photograph. The message is from Gregory himself. He says you're the vanguard of an attack from a direction he can no longer reliably discern. It is even possible you were an agent of the Kiev government. You must therefore be captured at all costs. You must be brought to him alive." Better than the alternative, I suppose. "Did the doorman tell you anything?" "Plenty," Reacher said. "But the journalist told me more."
"She talked to you?"
"It's about fake news on the internet. It was coming in from Russia. Now it's inside the United States. We can't block it anymore. She figured Moscow hired the Ukrainians as a proxy. Then about 2 months ago, the standard went way up. She said the geeks at the paper figured the Ukrainians must have brought in new talent. No other way to explain it." "Trulenko went into hiding about 2 months ago." "Exactly," Reacher said. "He's smart with computers. He's managing the contract. The Russian government is paying Gregory, and Gregory is paying Trulenko. After taking a healthy percentage for himself, I'm sure. Must feel like Christmas morning. The journalist said the contract could be worth tens of millions of dollars." "What did the doorman tell you?" "It's a secret satellite operation physically separate from the main office. He didn't know where it is, or how big it is, or who works there, or how many."
"You call that telling you plenty?"
"If we put the two things together, we can start to work out what they need. Security, accommodations, reliable power, reliable internet speed. Isolated, but close enough for easy supply and resupply. Could be any basement in town. They could have run new wires and put in a couple of cots." "More than cots," Reacher said. "This is an annual contract. No doubt renewable. Could be a long-term project." "Okay. As well as the wires, they also brought in wallboard and paint and put carpet on the floor. Maybe king-size beds." "We better start looking," Abby said. "Something else first," Reacher said. "That awful photograph reminded me. I want to go pay that guy a visit. It's after 12 o'clock. I bet he's holding a bunch of repayments. The Sheviks need money today. We're still a grand short." This time, Abby drove. Reacher could feel the weight in the back. The rear end of the car squatted and dragged. There were more than 600 pounds in the trunk, maybe never taken into account during Lincoln's design process. They stopped short of the bar in a side street. Did Situation C call for extra guards everywhere? Reacher guessed not everywhere. Insufficient manpower. They would consolidate their resources only where they mattered most, their high-value targets. Did the money-lending operation qualify? He wasn't sure. He got out and peered around the corner, one-eyed around the brick. The street was empty. There was nothing parked outside the bar. There were no guys in suits leaning on walls. He got back in and they drove on, across the street with the bar and around to the alley behind. It was the old part of town, built around the time Alexander Graham Bell was inventing the telephone, so anything newer was grafted on as an afterthought. There were leaning poles carrying sagging thickets of wires and cables, looping here, looping there. There were water meters and gas meters and electricity meters, screwed randomly to the walls. There were head-high garbage receptacles. There was a black Lincoln parked behind the bar. Empty. The pale guy's ride, no doubt. Ready for the journey home at the end of the day. Abby stopped behind it. "Can I help?" she asked. "You want to?" he asked back. "Yes," she said. "Walk around to the front. Come in the door like a regular person. Pause for a second. The guy sits in the rear right-hand corner. Walk toward the rear wall." "Why?" "I want the guy distracted. He'll watch you all the way. Partly because maybe you're a new customer. But mostly because you're the best-looking thing he's seen all day. Maybe all his life. Ignore the barman, whatever he says. He's an asshole." "Got it," she said. "You want a gun?"
"Should I?"
"Can't hurt," he said.
"Okay," she said.
He gave her the lounge doorman's H&K. It looked dainty in his hand and huge in hers. She hefted it a couple of times and stuck it in her pocket. She headed off down the alley. Reacher found the bar's back door. It was a plain steel panel, dull and old, scarred and dented low down by hand trucks wheeling kegs and crates. He tried the handle. It was unlocked. No doubt a city regulation. It was a fire exit, too. Reacher slipped inside. He was at the far end of a short corridor, restrooms to the left and right. Then a door for employees only, an office or a storeroom, or both. Then the end of the corridor and the room itself, seen in reverse. The square bar now in the near right corner, the worn central track leading away between the long rows of four-top tables. The same as before. The light was still dim and the air still smelled of spilled beer and disinfectant. This time, there were five customers, once again each of them alone at separate tables, defending their drinks, looking miserable. Behind the bar was the same fat guy, now with a six-day beard, but a fresh towel thrown over his shoulder. The pale guy was at the back table on Reacher's left, the same as before, luminescent in the gloom, glittering hair, thick white wrists, big white hands, a thick black ledger, the same black suit, the same white shirt, the same black silk necktie, the same tattoo. Abby stepped in the street door. She stood still as it closed behind her. Performance art. Every eye was on her. She was softly backlit by the dull neon in the windows, petite and gamine, neat and slender, dressed all in black. Short dark hair, lively dark eyes, a shy but contagious smile, a stranger dropping by, hoping for a welcome. She didn't get one. All five customers looked away. But the barman didn't. Neither did the pale guy. She set out walking, and they watched her all the way. Reacher took a step. He was 6 feet behind the pale guy and 6 feet to the side, no doubt in the corner of his eye. But hopefully Abby was feeling all of it. She kept on coming, and he took another step. The barman called out, "Hey!" He had been in the corner of the barman's eye, too. 6 feet behind, 6 feet to the side. All kinds of things happened next. Like a complex ballet. Like a triple play in baseball. The pale guy glanced back, started to get up. Reacher stepped away toward the bar, where he grabbed the barman's fat head in both hands and jumped up and thrust it down and smashed it on the mahogany, like dunking a basketball from way high in the air, and he used the bounce of his landing to pivot back to the pale guy. One step, two, and he hit him with a colossal straight right, all his moving mass behind it, center of the guy's face as he rose up from his chair, and the guy disappeared backward like he had been shot out of a cannon. He slid and sprawled on the floor, flat on his back, blood coming out of his nose and his mouth. All five customers got up and hurried out the door. may be a traditional local response in such situations, in which case Reacher applauded the habit. It left no witnesses. There were blood and teeth on the bar top, but the barman himself had fallen backward out of sight.
"I guess he didn't watch me all the way," Abby said.
"I told you," Reacher said. "He's an asshole."
They crouched next to the pale guy and took his gun and his phone and his car key and what looked like about $8,000 from his pockets. His nose was badly busted. He was breathing through his mouth. Flecks of blood were bubbling at the corners of his lips. Reacher remembered him tapping his glittering head with his bone-white finger. Some kind of a threatening implication. He thought, how the mighty are fallen. He said, "Yes or no?" Abby was quiet a beat. Then she said, "Yes." Reacher clamped his palm over the guy's mouth. Hard to keep it there, because it was slippery with blood. But he prevailed. The guy wasted time scrabbling for his pocket, looking for his gun, which was no longer there. And then he wasted the rest of his life drumming his heels and clawing uselessly at Reacher's wrist. Eventually, he went limp. And then still. They took the pale guy's Lincoln, because its trunk was empty. It rode much better. They drove downtown and parked on a hydrant around a corner from the Chevik's hotel. Abby checked the new phone. No new texts. Nothing since the conspiracy theory from Gregory. "Was it from his own number?" Reacher asked. Abby compared it with previous texts.
"I guess," she said. "It isn't the usual number."
"We should call him again. Keep him updated."
Abby dabbed a shortcut from the text screen and put the phone on speaker. They heard it ring. They heard it answered. Gregory said a word, short and urgent. Probably not hello. Probably shoot, or yes, or what.
"Speak English," Reacher said.
"You.
You just lost two more. I'm coming for you, Gregory."
"Who are you?"
"Not from Kiev."
"Then from where?"
"The 110th Special MP.
"What is that?"
"You'll find out pretty soon."
"What do you want from me?"
"You made a mistake."
"What mistake?"
"You crossed a line. So get ready. Payback time is here."
"You're American."
"As apple pie."
Gregory paused a long moment, no doubt thinking, no doubt about his wide network of bribes paid and palms greased and backs scratched and favors owed and hair-trigger early warning tripwires carefully set in place, any or all of which should have alerted him long ago. But he had heard nothing from anywhere.
"You're not a cop," he said. "You're not a government man. You're on your own, aren't you?
Which I'm sure will make it all the harder for you to take when your organization is in ruins and all your men are dead, except for you, because you're the last one alive, and then I step in through the door."
"You won't get near me."
"How am I doing so far?"
No answer.
"Get ready," Reacher said. "I'm coming for you." Then he clicked off the call and threw the phone out the window. They drove on, around the corner, and they parked in a 10-minute bay outside the Chevik's Hotel.
Chapter 42. Reacher and Abby rode the elevator up to the Chevik's floor, which was low to medium by New York or Chicago standards. But by local standards, it was probably the highest point for 100 miles around. They found the right door. Maria Chevik looked at them through the peephole and let them in. The room was a suite. It had a separate living room. It was bright and fresh and new and clean. There were two huge floor-to-ceiling windows, set at a right angle in the corner. It was early afternoon, and the sun was high and the air was clear. The view was spectacular. The city lay spread out below, like the hotel map Reacher had studied, now come to life. Abby unveiled the money. The banded 10 grand from the charnel house in back of the lumberyard, and close to 8 from the money-lending bar. So much it thumped and bounced on the table, and some of it fluttered to the floor. The Sheviks practically laughed with joy. Today's problem solved. Aaron decided he would pay it in at the bank, and then send a wire to the hospital in the normal business-like way. A last shred of dignity. Abby offered to walk with him to the downtown branch, just for the company. No other reason. No need for one. By that point, Aaron was walking much better, and east of center was now safe as houses. So, just for fun. They left together, and Reacher went back to the windows, back to the view. Maria sat on a narrow sofa behind him. She said, "Do you have children?" "I don't think so," Reacher said. "None that I know of, anyway." He was looking at the city below him, the fat part of the pear shape. The corner windows showed him the whole of the northwest quadrant, from about 9 on a clock face to 12. He could see Center Street more or less directly below. Close by, beyond it, to his half left, were two office towers and another high-rise hotel. They looked brand new. They speared bravely upward from a uniform and spreading carpet of 3- and 4-story buildings, mostly old, mostly brick, mostly dowdy. They had flat roofs, patched and painted silver. Most had air conditioning units sitting on angle iron frames. There were metal exhaust chimneys coming up from restaurant kitchens, and satellite dishes the size of trampolines, and parking garages with open top decks. The streets were narrow, in some places choked with traffic, in others empty and quiet. There were tiny people walking, turning left, turning right, going in and coming out of doorways. The vista continued into the hazy distance. "Could be any basement in town," Fantresca had said. Maria asked, "Are you married?" "No," Reacher said. "Don't you want to be?" "The decision is only 50% mine," he said. "I guess that would explain it." He turned back and looked at the view, like he had looked at the map. Where would a competent commander hide a secret satellite operation? What kind of place? Security, accommodations, power, internet, isolation, easy supply and resupply. He looked for possibilities. The carpet of small brown buildings, the winking roofs, the traffic. "Abby likes you," Maria said. "Maybe," Reacher said. "You don't want to admit it." "I agree she's putting in some hard time here. I assume there's a reason." "You don't think you're it?" Reacher smiled. He said, "What are you, my mother?" No answer. Reacher kept on looking. As always, the answer depended. If the southwest quadrant was the same as the northwest, then there were either fewer than 10 or more than 100 possible places. It depended on standards. It depended on what part of security, accommodations, power, internet, isolation, and easy supply a person didn't understand. He said, "What's the news on Meg?" She said, "The mood is still good. The scan tomorrow should confirm it. Everyone thinks so. Personally, I feel like we're gambling. Surely now this has to be it. It's either a huge, huge win, or it's a devastating loss. I would take those odds, win or lose. I like the simplicity. It's brutal. Only if you lose. Do you always win? So far. How can you?" "I can't," Reacher said. "I can't always win. One day I'm going to lose. I know that. But not today. I know that too." "I wish you were a doctor." "I don't even have a postgraduate degree." She paused a beat and said, "You told me you could find him." "I will," Reacher said, "today. Before the close of business." They all met back at Frank Barton's house, deep in what used to be Albanian territory. There was still smoke in the sky from the lumberyard fire. Barton and Hogan were back from their gig, and Vantresca was hanging out, and Reacher and Abby were fresh from their visit with the Sheviks. They all crowded in the front parlor. Once again, it was full of gear. It couldn't stay in the van. It would get stolen. Hogan said, "The key to this thing is first you gotta figure out, are you second-guessing a smart guy, or a really smart guy, or a genius? Because that's three different locations right there."
"Gregory seems smart enough," Reacher said. "I'm sure he has a certain degree of rat-like cunning. But I doubt that this was his decision."
"Not if it was an official contract, worth tens of millions of dollars, with the government of a foreign country. I would guess that's pretty much a seller's market. I bet there were all kinds of clauses and conditions and inspections and approvals. Moscow would have wanted the very best. And they ain't dumb over there. They know a bad idea when they see one. So in terms of location, I suggest we start second-guessing at the genius level." Van Tresca said, "Security, accommodations, power, internet, isolation, ease of supply."
"Start at the end," Reacher said. "Ease of supply. How many blocks from their office is easy?"
"More about what kind of block," Hogan said. "I would guess the whole of downtown, the business district, anywhere with commercial zoning. Weird things come and go all the time. No one pays attention. Not like in a residential neighborhood. I would say the edge of downtown is the natural limit, west of Center Street."
"That's not isolated," Barton said. "It's right in the hustle and the bustle."
"It's like hiding in plain sight. Maybe not physically isolated, but very anonymous all the same. There are all kinds of comings and goings, and no one sees a thing. No one knows anyone else's name."
Reacher asked, "What do they need for the internet?"
Van Tresca said, "A mechanically robust connection to a cable ISP or a satellite. Probably the satellite, because it would be harder to trace."
"There are plenty of satellite dishes in town. Lots of people use them."
"What do they need for power?"
"A recent installation, up to code, with excess capacity as a safety margin, and automatic generator backup in case of an outage on the grid. They can't afford interruptions, might screw up their gear."
"What about accommodations?"
"Bedrooms, bathrooms, a mess hall, maybe a TV room, maybe a rec room. Table tennis or something.
Sounds like federal prison."
"I think windows," Abby said, "not a basement. This could be a long contract. Trulenko is a superstar. Maybe down on his luck right now, but even so, he has standards. He'll want to live close to normal. He'll demand it."
"Okay, windows," Reacher said. "Which brings us to security."
"Iron bars on the windows," Barton said.
"Or anonymity," Hogan said. "There are a million windows. Sometimes the lights are on, sometimes they're off. No one cares."
Van Tresca said, "They need a single controllable point of entry, probably with an advanced screen some way upstream and a last chance backup a little ways downstream. Maybe you have to come in through a basement and then go up the back stairs. Something like that. Under scrutiny all the way. Like passing through a long tunnel. Metaphorically, if not literally."
"So where?"
"There are 1,000 buildings like that. You've seen them."
"I don't like them," Reacher said, "because they're all joined together. Because of the Navy SEALs. Hogan laid it all out back at the beginning. They would look for emergency exits and delivery bays and ventilation shafts and water pipes and sewers and so on. But most of all, they would look for places where they could gain access by demolishing walls between adjacent structures. You know how that goes down. They wake up some old geezer in the city plans department and he finds a dusty old blueprint that shows this guy's cellar connects to that guy's cellar, except some other guy bricked it up in 1920, but only single skin and poor quality mortar. You could breathe on it and it would fall down. Or they could come in sideways, through a first floor wall, or window, or the top floor, or they could rappel off the roof. Don't forget, the Moscow government made this decision. It was big business. Maybe the contract would run for years. Therefore, they wanted exactly the right location, which they are more than qualified to judge. They know all our tricks. They know our special forces train all the time in urban environments exactly like this one. But out of town is not easy to supply. Impossible to have both at once. No such thing is impossible. Merely a failure of planning. I think they got what they wanted. Very close at hand, so it's no problem to drop by with a cup of sugar. But also seriously isolated. Potentially hundreds of feet from the nearest other person. Rock-solid infrastructure in terms of wires and cables and automatic generators and mechanically robust connections. Luxurious accommodations flooded with sunshine and natural daylight. Categorically impossible to penetrate from the sides, or even approach, or from below, or from above. Zero significant penetration by water pipes or ventilation shafts. A single, controllable entry. Plenty of opportunity for upstream early warning, and as many defensive backups as they want. I think Moscow specified the place of their dreams, and I think they found it. Where? Abby said. I was looking right at it, through the hotel window, with Maria Shevik, when she asked me if I wanted to get married. To her? I think generically. What did you say? I said it takes two to tango. Where is Trulenko? It's a nest, not a hive or a burrow. It's up in the air. They rented three high floors in one of those new office towers. There are two of them west of center. They use the top and bottom floors as buffer zones, and they live and work on the middle floor. Can't get to them up or down, or side to side. Chapter 43. They discussed the deal breakers one by one. Security, accommodations, power, internet, isolation, ease of supply. Three high floors in a brand new downtown office tower met every objection. The elevators could be reprogrammed. No problem for Trulenko. Only one car would be allowed to stop. The other doors could be welded shut from the outside. Likewise, the stairwell doors. The lone functioning elevator could open into a cage. Maybe hurricane fencing installed inside the hallway. Some kind of padlocked gate. Men with guns. The elevator doors would close behind the visitor, who would then be trapped behind the wire. Plenty of time for scrutiny. If the visitor even got that far. There would be guys in the lobby, maybe leaning up near the elevator buttons. Maybe a lot of them, because of Situation C. They would be on the lookout for unfamiliar faces. Which tower? Abby asked. There must be paperwork, Reacher said. Some city department. Three floors, leased by an unknown corporation with a bland and forgettable name. Or we could talk to the supers. We could ask them about weird deliveries, maybe scaffolding components or a commercial dog run, something like that, for the cage. Which is going to be a problem, Hogan said. I don't see how we get in. We? Sooner or later your luck will run out. You'll need the Marines to rescue you. You army boys always do. Much more efficient if I prevent that necessity up front by supervising the operation from the get-go.
I'm in too, Van Treska said. Same reason, essentially. Me as well, Barton said.
Silence for a beat. Full disclosure, Reacher said. This will not be a walk in the park. No objections.
What first? Van Treska asked.
You and Barton figure out which tower and which three floors. The rest of us will go pay a visit to their main office, behind the taxi company, across from the pawn shop, next to the bail bond operation.
Why?
Because some of the greatest mistakes in history are made by secret satellite operations cut off from the mothership. No command and control. No information. No orders. No leadership. No resupply. Complete isolation. That's what I want for these guys. Quickest way to get it is just go right ahead and destroy the mothership. No need to pussyfoot around. The time for subtlety is long gone.
You really don't like these people.
You didn't speak well of them yourself.
They'll have sentries all over the place.
Doubly so now, Reacher said. I've been calling Gregory on the phone and yanking his chain. No doubt he's a big, brave fellow. But even so, I bet he called in extra reinforcements. Just to be sure.
Then it was a dumb idea to yank his chain.
No. I want them all in one place. Well, all in two places. The mothership and the satellite. Nowhere else. No loose ends. No waifs or strays. We could call it Situation D. Much more satisfactory. Massed targets are always more efficient than running after lone fugitives individually. That would take days in a place like this. We would be chasing around all over town. Best avoided, surely. We're in a hurry here. We should let them do some of the work for us.
You're nuts. You know that?
Says the guy prepared to drive in a straight line at 25 miles an hour toward nuclear-tipped anti-tank artillery.
That was different.
How, exactly? Van Tresca said, I guess I'm not sure. Find the tower, Reacher said. Get the floor numbers.
They used the moneylender's Lincoln again. Commonplace, west of center. And untouchable. Abby drove. Hogan sat next to her in the front. Reacher sprawled in the back. The streets were quiet. Not much traffic. No cops at all. The cops were east of center, every single one of them. Guaranteed. By that point, the fire department would be pulling crispy skeletons out of the wreckage, one after the other. A big sensation. Everyone would want to be there. Stories for the grandchildren. Abby stopped on a hydrant, four blocks directly behind the pawn shop, which was directly across the street from the taxi dispatcher. A straight line on a map. A simple linear progression. How far out will the sentries be posted? Reacher asked.
Not far, Hogan said. They have to cover the full 360. They can't waste manpower. They'll keep it tight. All four corners of the block their office is on. That would be my assessment. Maybe they're even stopping traffic. But nothing more than that.
So they can see the front of the pawn shop and the front of the taxi dispatcher. From both ends of the street. Probably two guys per corner.
But they can't see the back of the pawn shop.
No, Hogan said. To go one street wider in every direction would cost them three times the manpower. Simple math. They can't afford it.
Okay, Reacher said. Good to know. We'll go in the back of the pawn shop.
We should, anyway. We should get Maria's heirlooms back. They lowballed her with $80. I didn't like that. We should express our disapproval. Maybe their guilty consciences will prompt them to make a generous donation to a medical charity.
They got out and left the car on the curb next to the fire plug. Reacher figured a parking ticket was the least of Gregory's problems. They walked the first block, then the second. Then they got cautious. Maybe no one was posted a block further out. But they could eyeball a block further out. That would be dead easy. They could raise their sight lines from time to time, to stare off into the distance. They could make out faces a block away, and speed, and intent, and body language. Accordingly, Reacher kept close to the storefront windows, in the sharp afternoon shadows, widely separated from Abby, who followed 20 feet behind, and then Hogan, all of them strolling, randomly stopping, showing no link between them, in terms of lockstep speed, or direction, or purpose. Reacher turned left into the mouth of the cross street, out of sight. He waited. Abby joined him, then Hogan. They formed up and walked on together, 10 paces on the far sidewalk. Then they stopped again. Geographically speaking, the pawn shop's rear exit would be ahead on the right. But there were many rear exits ahead on the right, and they were all the same, and they were all unmarked. There were 12 in total. Every establishment had one. Reacher clicked back in his head to their earlier visit, the search and rescue mission in Abby's old Toyota, a grimy pawn shop across a narrow street from a taxi dispatcher and a bail bond operation, Maria coming out the door, Abby pulling over, Aaron winding down his window and calling out her name. I remember it as the middle of the block, he said.
Except 12 has no middle, Abby said.
12 has 6 to the left and 6 to the right and nothing in the actual middle. Because it's an even number. The middle is a choice of two. The last of the first 6, or the first of the last 6. Abby said, I remember it as not the exact middle of the block. Before the middle, or after it? Maybe after it. Maybe even 2/3 of the way along. I remember seeing her, and pulling over. I think it was after the middle of the block.
Okay, Reacher said. We'll start by taking a look at numbers 7, 8, and 9.
The buildings were all joined together, and their rear facades were all the same, tall and mean and narrow, built of sullen 100-year-old brick, pierced here and there randomly by barred windows, festooned all over with wires and cables, drooping and looping from one connection to another. Not always mechanically robust. The rear doors themselves were all the same, all stout, identical 100-year-old items, inward opening, made of wood. But at some point, maybe 50 years previously, someone had screwed sheets of metal over the lower halves for durability. Maybe a new landlord making improvements. The metal sheets showed half a century of wear and tear, from loading and unloading, shipping and receiving, kicking open, kicking shut, banging in and out with hand trucks and trolleys and dollies. Reacher checked. Less so on number 8 than 7 or 9. In fact, much less. In fact, not bad at all for 50 years. Number 8. The exact definition of 2/3 the way along a block of 12. He said, I think this is the one. Not much comes in or out of a pawn shop on a hand truck or a dolly. Only an occasional item. Like if Barton hocked his speaker cabinet. But most everything else comes in and out in a hand or a pocket. The door was locked from the inside. Not a fire exit. Not a bar. Not a restaurant. A different regulation. The wood of the door was solid. The frame, maybe not so much. Softer lumber, infrequently painted. Maybe a little rotted and spongy. He asked, what would the Marine Corps do?
Bazooka, Hogan said. Best way into any building. Pull the trigger. Step through the smoking hole.
Suppose you didn't have a bazooka.
Obviously, we'll have to kick the door down. But we better get it done first time. They got a dozen guys within range of a holler for help. We can't get hung up back here.
Did they teach you kicking down doors in the Corps?
No. They gave us bazookas.
Force equals mass times acceleration. Take a running start. Stamp your foot flat through the door.
I'm doing this?
Below the handle.
I thought it was above the handle.
Nearest the keyhole. That's where the tongue of the lock is. That's where the most amount of wood has been chiseled out of the frame. Hence, where it's weakest. That's what you're looking for. It's always the frame that breaks, never the door.
Now, we'll be right behind you.
Hogan backed off, perpendicular to the door, 10 or 12 feet, and he lined up and rocked back and forth, and then he launched, with the kind of grim, bouncy focus Reacher had seen on TV, from high jumpers going for the record. He was a musician and a younger man, with physical rhythm and grace and energy, which was why Reacher was making him do the job. The decision paid off big time. Hogan flowed in and jumped up and twisted in midair and smashed his heel below the handle, like a short-order cook stamping on a roach, hard and snappy and perfectly timed. The door crashed back, and Hogan stutter-stepped through and stumbled inside, all windmilling arms and momentum, and then Reacher crowded in after him, and then Abby, into a short, dark hallway, toward a half-glass door with private written on it backward in gold. There was no reason to stop. No real possibility, either. Hogan burst through the half-glass door, followed by Reacher, followed by Abby, into the shop itself, behind the counter, right by the register, in front of which was a small weasel-like guy, turning to face them, full of shock and surprise. Hogan hit him in the chest with a lowered shoulder, which bounced him off the counter straight into Reacher, who caught him and spun him around and touched an H and K to the side of his head. He wasn't sure which one. He had chosen blind. But no matter. By that point, he knew all of them worked. Abby took the guy's gun. Hogan found his daily ledger. A big book, handwritten. Maybe a city regulation. Maybe just pawnbroker tradition. Hogan slid his finger up a bunch of lines.
"Here it is," he said. "Maria Shevik, wedding bands, small solitaires, a watch with a broken crystal, $80. Reacher asked the guy, "Where is that stuff?" The guy said,
"I could get it for you."
"You think $80 was fair?"
"Fair is what the market will bear. It depends how desperate people are."
"How desperate are you right now?" Reacher asked.
"I could certainly get that stuff for you."
"What else?"
"I could maybe add a couple of pieces. Something nice. Maybe bigger diamonds."
"You got money?"
"Sure I do. Yes, of course."
"How much?"
"Probably $5,000. You can have it all."
"I know we can," Reacher said. "That goes without saying. We can take what we want. But that's the least of your worries. Because this is about more than just a mean transaction. You ran across the street and ratted the old lady out. You caused no end of trouble. Why was that?"
"Are you from Kiev?"
"No," Reacher said. "But I had their chicken once. It was pretty good."
"What do you want from me?"
"Gregory is going down. We need to decide if you're going down with him."
"I get a text. I got to respond. No choice. Those are the terms, man."
"What terms?"
"This was my store once. He took it from me. He made me lease it back. There are unwritten conditions."
"You gotta run across the street."
"No choice."
"What's it like over there?"
"Like?"
the guy said. "The layout," Reacher said.
"You go in the hallway on the left. There's a door on the right to the taxi room. It's a real operation. But you go straight on to the back. There's a conference room. You walk through it to another corridor in the opposite back corner. That's how you get to the offices. The last one is Danilo's. You go through Danilo's office to get to Gregory's office."
"How often do you go over there?"
"Only when I have to."
"You work for them. But you don't want to."
"That's the truth of it."
"Everyone says that."
"I'm sure they do. But I mean it."
Reacher said nothing. Abby said, "No." Hogan said, "No." Reacher said, "Go get the stuff we talked about." The guy went and got it. The wedding bands, the small solitaires, the broken watch. He put them all in an envelope. Reacher put the envelope in his pocket, plus all the cash from the register. About $5,000. Hopefully, the merest drop in the bucket pretty soon. But Reacher liked cash. He always had. He liked the heft and the deadness. Hogan roamed the store's shelves and tore the cords off all the dusty old stereo items, and he tied the guy up with them, secure. Uncomfortable, but survivable. Eventually, someone would find him and let him go. What happened after that would be up to him. They left the guy on the floor behind the counter. They stepped out to the well of the store. They looked out the dusty front windows at the taxi dispatcher across the street.
Chapter 44. They managed to scope out the whole of the block by staying back in the pawn shop, back in the shadows, traversing side to side, peering out at oblique angles. There were two guys on the sidewalk outside the taxi office door, and two guys some distance away on the left-hand street corner, and two guys the same distance away on the right. 6 men visible. Plus, probably the same again inside, at least. Maybe 2 in the hallway the pawnbroker had described, plus 2 in the conference room, plus 2 at the mouth of the corridor that led onward to the offices, each of which was no doubt occupied by a made man with a gun in his pocket and a spare in a drawer. Not good. What the military academies would call a tactical challenge, a head-on assault against a numerically superior opponent in a tightly constrained battle space. Added to which, the guys from the street corners would fold into the action from the rear. Bad guys in front, bad guys behind,
No body armor, no grenades, no automatic weapons, no shotguns, no flamethrower. Reacher said, I guess the real question is whether Gregory trusts Danilo.
Does that matter? Hogan said.
Why wouldn't he?
Abby asked.
Two reasons, Reacher said. First, he trusts no one. You don't get to be Gregory by trusting people. He's a snake. So he assumes everyone else is a snake. And second, Danilo is by far his biggest threat. The second in command. The leader in waiting. It's on the news every night. The generals get deposed, and the colonels take over.
Does this help us?
You have to go through Danilo's office to get to Gregory's office.
That's normal, Hogan said. Everyone does it that way. That's how a chief of staff operates.
Think about it in reverse. In order to leave his own office, Gregory has to walk through Danilo's office. And he's paranoid, with good reason, and with good results. He's still alive. In his head, this is not necessarily like a CEO in a movie, saying goodnight to his secretary and calling her sweetheart. This is like walking into a death trap. This is assassination squads behind the desk. Or maybe even worse, this is a blockade, until he accedes to their demands. Maybe they'll let him step down with his dignity intact.
Abby nodded.
Human nature, she said. Mostly bullshit, but sometimes it rings a bell.
What? Hogan said.
He built an emergency exit.
They went back behind the counter and sat on the floor against the cabinets, not far from the tied-up guy. A high-level staff conference, always held behind the lines. Hogan played the part of the gloomy Marine, partly because he was, and partly as a professional obligation. Every plan had to be stress-tested, from every possible direction. He said, worst case, we're going to find exactly the same situation, but flipped around 180. Guys on the sidewalk the next street over, watching the back door, and then more guys inside, in narrow corridors, just the same. There's a word for it.
Symmetrical, Reacher said.
Gotta be.
Human nature, Abby said. Mostly bullshit, but sometimes it rings a bell.
What now?
It's a bad look, she said. An escape hatch makes him look scared. Best case, it makes it look like he doesn't trust the protection he bought or the army of loyal soldiers standing in front of him. He can't admit to any of those feelings. He's Gregory. He has no weaknesses. His organization has no weaknesses.
So?
The emergency exit is secret. No one is guarding it, because no one knows it exists.
Not even Danilo?
Most of all not Danilo, Reacher said. He is the biggest threat. This was done behind Danilo's back. I bet you could troll through the records and find a 2-week spell when he was sent away somewhere, and just before he got back, I bet you would find a couple of construction workers mysteriously dead in some kind of gruesome accident.
So that no one except Gregory would know where the secret tunnel is.
Exactly.
Which includes us.
We don't know where it is either.
Some guy's cellar connects to some other guy's cellar.
That's your plan? Think about it from Gregory's point of view. This is a guy who got where he is by taking no chances at all. He's thinking about slamming the door on an assassination attempt and getting the hell out of there. A high-stress situation. He can't afford confusion. He needs it clear and simple. Maybe arrows on the wall. Maybe emergency lighting, like on an airplane. All we need to do is find the street door at the far end. We can go in and follow the arrows backward. Maybe we'll come out behind an oil painting on his office wall. We'll have all the same people ahead of us. Except in reverse order. They'll come pouring in through the office door.
We can only hope.
I don't see what we gain.
Two things, Reacher said. We'll have no one behind us, and we'll be taking them out from the top to the bottom instead of the bottom to the top. Much more efficient.
Wait, Hogan said. There are guys on the street corners. Symmetrical.
The back corners become the front corners. It won't be easy to get in.
If I want it easy,
I would have joined the Marines.
They left the pawn shop the same way they came in, through the back hallway, through the rear door, out to the cross street. They hustled back to the car, at first cautious and then fast. The car was still there. No ticket. Even the traffic cops were east of center. Abby drove. She knew her way around. She made a wide loop, well out of sight of the taxi office. She stopped two blocks behind it, on a quiet street, outside a mom-and-pop store that sold washing machine hoses. She left the motor running. Hogan got out, and she scooted across to the passenger seat. Hogan walked around the hood and got in again behind the wheel. Reacher stayed in the back. "Ready?" he said. A tight nod from Hogan. A determined nod from Abby. "Okay. Let's do it," he said. Hogan drove the rest of the block and made a left at the end. A block ahead in the new direction were two guys on the corner, on the far sidewalk, black suits, white shirts. Previously the far left corner, now the near right corner. Symmetrical. They were standing with their backs to the block they were guarding, looking outward, like good sentries should. What they saw was one of their own cars cruising toward them, a black Lincoln. Indistinct faces behind the windshield, black glass in the back. It made the left in front of them, into the cross street. Gregory's real estate on the right, civilian real estate on the left. And way up ahead, two more guys on the next corner. Previously the far right, now the near left. The car slowed and stopped on the curb. The rear window rolled down and a hand came out and beckoned. The guys on the corner took a step toward it, automatically. Reflex action. Then they stopped and thought about it. But they didn't change their minds. Why would they? It was their car, and anyone important enough to be out and about during Situation C wouldn't want to be kept waiting. So they started up again and hustled. Mistake. The front door opened when they were 10 feet away, and Abby stepped out. The rear door opened just as they got there, and Reacher stepped out. He headbutted the first to arrive, barely any effort or movement, all about timing and momentum, like a soccer forward meeting a hard cross from out wide. The guy went down in the gutter, his head cracked on the curbstone. Not his day. Reacher moved on to the second guy, a face he suddenly realized he knew, from the bar with the tiny pizzas and Abby waiting tables. The guy on the door. "Run along now, kid," he had said to her. "I'll see you again," Reacher had said to him. "I hope." Good things come to those who wait. Reacher popped him with a short left to the face, just a tap, to straighten him up for a second short left, this time to the gut, to bend him over, to bring his head down to a convenient position, which was chest height to Reacher. Maybe a little below, so he could grab it and twist it and jerk it with all the torque in his upper body. The neck broke, and the guy went down, pretty close to his pal. Reacher squatted between them and took the magazines out of their pistols. The Lincoln drove away. Reacher watched. The guys on the far corner had come closer. Inevitable. Symmetrical. For the same reasons. They were still coming closer. Now they were running. Hogan accelerated hard and mounted the sidewalk and smashed straight into them. Not pretty. They came flailing up in the air, proving all the clichés true, like rag dolls, like they were flying. Probably they were already dead, from the impact. Certainly they made no attempt to cushion their fall. They just smashed down, sliding, rolling, scraping, arms and legs everywhere. Hogan parked the car and got out. Reacher got up and started walking. They met in the middle of the block. Abby was already there. She pointed back the way Hogan had come. She said, "It's that way." "How can you tell?" Reacher asked. It was not the kind of street he was expecting. Not like behind the pawn shop. There was no sullen brick, no barred windows, no drooping wires or cables. Instead, there was a neat line of newly restored buildings, like the street with the law project office, clean and bright. In this case, mostly retail stores. Nicer and better than the strip with the taxi company and the bail bond operation. It was a block with two fronts, one coming up,
one staying down.
Abby said, I figured he would start from the outside in. He couldn't keep it a secret if he started from the inside out. He couldn't have construction workers trooping through the taxi office, not without questions being asked. So he started back here during the renovations, which was the perfect cover. He would have had access to detailed plans and surveys. He would have known what was connected to what. So he got it done. The back of one of these stores leads to the back of his office.
Symmetrical, Hogan said.
Only in principle, Abby said. I'm sure the reality is a warren full of dogleg turns. This block is more than 100 years old.
Which store? Reacher asked.
Human nature, Abby said. I figured in the end, he couldn't bring himself to rent it out. He needed to be absolutely sure. He didn't want to worry about someone putting a display cabinet against his secret door. He needed control. So I looked for vacant units. There's only one.